No simple blade or blow could kill him. No cell of bars could keep him safe within. So Telu carried Encarnis to the smithy. He called for iron, and people brought all they owned. Though he had taken no rest, nor a morsel of food, all through the ninth day Telu labored. While 10 men worked the bellows, Telu forged the great iron wheel. All night he worked, and when the first light of the 10th morning touched him, Telu struck the wheel one final time, and it was finished. Wrought all of black iron, the wheel stood taller than a man. It had 6 spokes, each thicker than a hammer's haft, and its rim was a handspan across. It weighed as much as 40 men, and was cold to the touch. The sound of its name was terrible, and none could speak it. Telu gathered the people who were watching, and chose a priest among them. Then he set them to dig a great pit in the center of the town, 15 feet wide and 20 feet deep. With the sun rising, Telu laid the body of the demon on the wheel. At the first touch of iron, Encarnis began to stir in his sleep. But Telu chained him tightly to the wheel, hammering the links together, sealing them tighter than any lock. Then Telu stepped back, and all saw Encarnis shift again, as if disturbed by an unpleasant dream. Then he shook and came awake entirely. Encarnis strained against the chains, his body arching upward as he pulled against them. Where the iron touched his skin, it felt like knives and needles and nails, like the searing pain of frost, like the sting of 100 biting flies. Encarnis thrashed on the wheel and began to howl as the iron burned and bit and froze him. To Telu, the sound was like a sweet music. He lay down on the ground beside the wheel and slept a deep sleep, for he was very tired. When he awoke, it was evening of the 10th day. Encarnis was still bound to the wheel, but he no longer howled and fought like a trapped animal. Telu bent, and with great effort lifted one edge of the wheel and set it leaning against a tree that grew nearby. As soon as he came close, Encarnis cursed him in languages no one knew, scratching and biting. "You brought this on yourself," Telu said. That night there was a celebration. Telu sent men to cut a dozen evergreens and use them to kindle a bonfire in the bottom of the deep pit they had dug. All night the townsfolk danced and sang around the burning fire. They knew the last and most dangerous of the world's demons was finally caught. And all night Encarnis hung from his wheel and watched them, motionless as a snake. When the morning of the 11th day came, Telu went to Encarnis a third and final time. The demon looked worn and feral. His skin was sallow, and his bones pressed tight against his skin. But his power still lay around him like a dark mantle, hiding his face in shadow. "Encarnis," Telu said, "this is your last chance to speak. Do it, for I know it is within your power."
"Lord Telu, I am not Encarnis."
For that brief moment, the demon's voice was pitiful, and all who heard it were moved to sorrow. But then there was a sound like quenching iron, and the wheel rung like an iron bell. Encarnis's body arched painfully at the sound, then hung limply from his wrists as the ringing of the wheel faded. "Try no tricks, Dark One. Speak no lies," Telu said sternly, his eyes as dark and hard as the iron of the wheel. "What then?" Encarnis hissed, his voice like the rasp of stone on stone. "What, rack and shatter you? What do you want of me?" "Your road is very short, Encarnis, but you may still choose a side on which to travel." Encarnis laughed. "Ha-ha! You will give me the same choice you gave the cattle? Yes, then I will cross to your side of the path. I regret and rep—" The wheel rung again, like a great bell tolling long and deep. Encarnis threw his body against the chains again, and the sound of his scream shook the earth and shattered stones for half a mile in each direction. When the sounds of wheel and scream had faded, Encarnis hung panting and shaking from his chains. "I told you to speak no lie, Encarnis," Telu said, pitiless. "My path, then," Encarnis shrieked, "I do not regret. If I had my choice again, I would only change how fast I ran. Your people are like cattle my kind feed on. Bite and break you, if you gave me half an hour, I would do such things that these wretched, gawping peasants would go mad with fear. I would drink their children's blood and bathe in women's tears." He might have said more, but his breath was short as he strained against the chains that held him. "So," Telu said, and stepped close to the wheel. For a moment it seemed like he would embrace Encarnis, but he was merely reaching for the iron spokes of the wheel. Then, straining, Telu lifted the wheel above his head. He carried it, arms upstretched towards the pit, and threw Encarnis in. Through the long hours of night, a dozen evergreens had fed the fire. The flames had died in the early morning, leaving a deep bed of sullen coals that glimmered when the wind brushed them. The wheel struck flat with Encarnis on top. There was an explosion of spark and ash as it landed and sank inches deep into the hot coals. Encarnis was held over the coals by the iron that bound and burned and bit at him. Though he was held away from the fire itself, the heat was so intense that Encarnis's clothes charred black and began to crumble without bursting into flame. The demon thrashed against his bonds, settling the wheel more firmly into the coals. Encarnis screamed because he knew that even demons can die from fire or iron. And though he was powerful, he was bound and burning. He felt the metal of the wheel grow hot beneath him, blackening the flesh of his arms and legs. Encarnis screamed, and even as his skin began to smoke and char, his face was still hidden in a shadow that rose from him like a tongue of darkening flame. Then Encarnis grew silent, and the only sound was the hiss of sweat and blood as they fell from the demon's straining limbs. For a long moment, everything was still. Encarnis strained against the chains that held him to the wheel, and it seemed that he would strain until his muscles tore themselves from bone and sinew both. Then there was a sharp sound like a bell breaking, and the demon's arm jerked free of the wheel. Links of chain, now glowing red from the heat of the fire, flew upward to land, smoking at the feet of those who stood above. The only sound was the sudden wild laughter of Encarnis, like breaking glass. In a moment, the demon's second hand was free, but before he could do more, Telu flung himself into the pit and landed with such force that the iron rang with it. Telu grabbed the hands of the demon and pressed them back against the wheel. Encarnis screamed in
fury and in disbelief, for though he was forced back onto the burning wheel, and though he felt the strength of Teilu was greater than chains he had broken, he saw Teilu was burning in the flames. "Fool," he wailed, "you will die here with me. Let me go and live. Let me go and I will trouble you no further." And the wheel did not ring out, for Encanis was truly frightened. "No," said Teilu, "your punishment is death. You will serve it." "Fool! Madling!" Encanis thrashed to no avail. "You are burning in the flames with me. You will die as I do." "To ash all things return, so too this flesh will burn. But I am Teilu, son of myself, father of myself. I was before and I will be after. If I am a sacrifice, then it is to myself alone, and if I am needed and called in the proper ways, then I will come again to judge and punish." So Teilu held him to the burning wheel, and none of the demon's threats or screaming moved him the least part of an inch. So it was that Encanis passed from the world, and with him went Teilu, who was Menda. Both of them burned to ash in the pit in Atur. That is why the Teilin priests wear robes of ashen grey. And that is how we know Teilu cares for us, and watches us, and keeps us safe from...
Trappist broke off his story, as Jaspin began to howl and thrash against his restraints. I slid softly back into unconsciousness as soon as I no longer had the story to hold my attention. After that, I began to harbor a suspicion that never entirely left me. Was Trappist a Teilin priest? His robe was tattered and dirty, but it might have been the proper grey long ago. Parts of his story had been awkward and stumbling, but some were stately and grand, as if he had been reciting them from some half-forgotten memory. Of sermons, of his readings from the Book of the Path. I never asked. And though I stopped by his basement frequently in the months that followed, I never heard Trappist tell another story again. Chapter 24. Shadows Themselves. Through all my time in Tarbin, I continued to learn, though most of the lessons were painful and unpleasant. I learned how to beg. It was a very practical application of acting with a very difficult audience. I did it well, but waterside money was tight, and an empty begging bowl meant a cold, hungry night. Through dangerous trial and error, I discovered the proper way to slit a purse and pick a pocket. I was especially good at the latter. Locks and latches of all kinds soon gave up their secrets to me. My nimble fingers were put to a use my parents or a Benthi never would have guessed. I learned to run from anyone with an unnaturally white smile. Denna resin slowly bleaches your teeth, so if a sweet eater lives long enough for their teeth to grow fully white, chances are they have already sold everything they have worth selling. Tarbin is full of dangerous people, but none as dangerous as a sweet eater filled with the desperate craving for more resin. They will kill you for a pair of pennies. I learned how to lash together makeshift shoes out of rags. Real shoes became a thing of dreams for me. The first 2 years it seemed like my feet were always cold or cut or both. But by the third year my feet were like old leather, and I could run barefoot for hours over the rough stones of the city and not feel it at all. I learned not to expect help from anyone. In the bad parts of Tarbin, a call for help attracts predators like the smell of blood on the wind. I was sleeping on the rooftops, snugged tightly into my secret place where three roofs met. I awoke from a deep sleep to the sound of harsh laughter and pounding feet in the alley below me. The slapping footsteps stopped, and more laughter followed the sound of ripping cloth. Slipping to the edge of the roof, I looked down to the alley below. I saw several large boys, almost men. They were dressed as I was, rags and dirt. There may have been 5, maybe 6 of them. They moved in and out of the shadows like shadows themselves. Their chests heaved from their run, and I could hear their breath from the roof above. The object of the chase was in the middle of the alley, a young boy, 8 years old at the most. One of the older boys was holding him down. The young boy's bare skin shone pale in the moonlight. There was another sound of ripping cloth, and the boy gave a soft cry that ended in a choked sob. The others watched and talked in low, urgent tones with each other, wearing hard, hungry smiles. I'd been chased before at night several times. I'd been caught, too, months ago. Looking down, I was surprised to find a heavy red roof tile in my hand, ready to throw. Then I paused, looking back to my secret place. I had a rag blanket and a half a loaf of bread there. My rainy day money was hidden here, 8 iron pennies I had hoarded for when my luck turned bad, and most valuable of all, Ben's book. I was safe here. Even if I hit one of them, the rest would be on the roof in 2 minutes. Then, even if I got away, I wouldn't have anywhere to go. I set down the tile. I went back to what had become my home, and curled myself into the shelter of the niche underneath the overhanging roof. I twisted my blanket in my hands and clenched my teeth, trying to shut out the low rumble of conversation, punctuated by coarse laughter and quiet, hopeless sobbing from below. Chapter 25. Interlude. Eager for reasons. Kvothe gestured for Chronicler to set down his pen and stretched, lacing his fingers together above his head.
"It's been a long time since I remembered that," he said. "If you are eager to find the reason I became the Kvothe they tell stories about, you could look there, I suppose."
Chronicler's forehead wrinkled.
"What do you mean, exactly?"
Kvothe paused for a long moment, looking down at his hands.
"Do you know how many times I've been beaten over the course of my life?"
Chronicler shook his head. Looking up, Kvothe grinned and tossed his shoulders in a nonchalant shrug.
"Neither do I. You'd think that sort of thing would stick in a person's mind. You'd think I would remember how many bones I've had broken. You'd think I'd remember the stitches and bandages."
He shook his head.
"I don't. I remember that young boy sobbing in the dark, clear as a bell after all these years."
Chronicler frowned.
"You said yourself that there was nothing you could have done."
"I could have," Kvothe said seriously. "And I didn't. I made my choice and I regret it to this day. Bones mend. Regret stays with you forever." Kvothe pushed himself away from the table.
"That's enough of Tarbin's darker side, I imagine."
He came to his feet and gave a great stretch, arms over his head.
"Why, Reshi?"
The words poured out of Bast in a sudden gush.
"Why did you stay there when it was so awful?"
Kvothe nodded to himself as if he had been expecting the question.
"Where else was there for me to go, Bast? Everyone I knew was dead."
"Not everyone," Bast insisted. "There was a Benthi, you could have gone to him."
"Hallowfell was hundreds of miles away, Bast," Kvothe said wearily as he wandered to the other side of the room and moved behind the bar. "Hundreds of miles without my father's maps to guide me, hundreds of miles without wagons to ride or sleep in, without help of any sort or money or shoes. Not an impossible journey, I suppose, but for a young child, still numb with the shock of losing his parents, Kvothe shook his head.
No. In Tarbin, at least, I could beg or steal. I'd managed to survive in the forest for a summer, barely, but over the winter?
He shook his head.
I would have starved or frozen to death.
Standing at the bar, Kvothe filled his mug and began to add pinches of spice from several small containers, then walked toward the great stone fireplace, a thoughtful expression on his face.
You're right, of course. Anywhere would have been better than Tarbin.
He shrugged, facing the fire.
But we are all creatures of habit. It is far too easy to stay in the familiar ruts we dig for ourselves. Perhaps I even viewed it as fair. My punishment for not being there to help when the Chandrian came. My punishment for not dying when I should have with the rest of my family.
Bast opened his mouth, then closed it and looked down at the tabletop, frowning. Kvothe looked over his shoulder and gave a gentle smile.
I'm not saying it's rational, Bast. Emotions, by their very nature, are not reasonable things. I don't feel that way now. But back then I did. I remember.
He turned back to the fire.
Ben's training has given me a memory so clean and sharp, I have to be careful not to cut myself sometimes.
Kvothe took a mulling stone from the fire and dropped it into his wooden mug. It sank with a sharp hiss. The smell of searing clove and nutmeg filled the room. Kvothe stirred his cider with a long-handled spoon as he made his way back to the table.
You must also remember that I was not in my right mind. Much of me was still in shock, sleeping, if you will. I needed something, or someone, to wake me up.
He nodded to Chronicler, who casually shook his writing hand to loosen it, then unstoppered his inkwell. Kvothe leaned back in his seat.
I needed to be reminded of things I had forgotten. I needed a reason to leave. It was years before I met someone who could do those things.
He smiled at Chronicler.
Before I met Scarpy.
Chapter 26. Lanray turned.
I had been in Tarbin for years at this point. 3 birthdays had slipped by unnoticed, and I was just past 15. I knew how to survive waterside. I'd become an accomplished beggar and thief. Locks and pockets opened to my touch. I knew which pawn shops bought goods from Uncle with no questions asked. I was still ragged and frequently hungry, but I was in no real danger of starving. I'd been slowly building my rainy day money. Even after a hard winter that had frequently forced me to pay for a warm spot to sleep, my hoard was over 20 iron pennies. It was like a dragon's treasure to me. I had grown comfortable there, but aside from the desire to add to my rainy day money, I had nothing to live for, nothing driving me, nothing to look forward to. My days were spent looking for things to steal and ways to entertain myself. But that had changed a few days earlier, in Trappis's basement. I had heard a young girl speaking, in an awed voice, about a storyteller who spent all his time in a dockside bar called the Half Mast. Apparently every 6th bell he told a story. Any story you asked for, he knew. What's more, she said that he had a bet going. If he didn't know your story, he would give you a whole talent. I thought about what the girl had said for the rest of the day. I doubted it was true, but I couldn't help thinking about what I could do with a whole silver talent. I could buy shoes and maybe a knife, give money to Trappist and still double my rainy day fund. Even if the girl was lying about the bet, I was still interested. Entertainment was hard to come by on the streets. Occasionally some ragamuffin troupe would mum a play on a street corner, or I'd hear a fiddler in a pub, but most real entertainment cost money, and my hard-won pennies were too precious to squander. But there was a problem. Dockside wasn't safe for me. I should explain. More than a year before, I had seen Pike walking down the street.
It had been the first time I'd seen him since my first day in Tarbin, when he and his friends had jumped me in that alley and destroyed my father's loot. I followed him carefully for the better part of a day, keeping my distance and staying in the shadows. Eventually, he went home to a little box alley dockside where he had his own version of my secret place. His was a nest of broken crates he had cobbled together to keep the weather off. I perched on the roof all night, waiting until he left the next morning. Then I made my way down to his nest of crates and looked around. It was cozy, filled with the accumulated small possessions of several years. He had a bottle of beer, which I drank. There was also half a cheese that I ate, and a shirt that I stole, as it was slightly less raggedy than my own. Further searching revealed various odds and ends, a candle, a ball of string, some marbles. Most surprising were several pieces of sailcloth with charcoal drawings of a woman's face. I had to search for nearly 10 minutes until I found what I was really looking for. Hidden away behind everything else was a small wooden box that showed signs of much handling. It held a bundle of dried violets tied with a white ribbon, a toy horse that had lost most of its string mane, and a lock of curling blonde hair. It took me several minutes with flint and steel to get the fire going. The violets were good tinder, and soon greasy clouds of smoke were billowing high into the air. I stood by and watched as everything Pike loved went up in flames. But I stayed too long, savoring the moment. Pike and a friend came running down the box alley, drawn by the smoke, and I was trapped. Furious, Pike jumped me. He was taller by 6 inches and outweighed me by 50 pounds. Worse, he had a piece of broken glass wrapped with twine at one end, making a crude knife. He stabbed me once in the thigh right above my knee, before I smashed his hand into the cobblestones, shattering the knife. After that, he still gave me a black eye and several broken ribs, before I managed to kick him squarely between the legs and get free. As I pelted away, he limped after me, shouting that he would kill me for what I'd done. I believed him. After patching up my leg, I took every bit of rainy day money I had saved and bought 5 pints of dreg, a cheap, foul liquor strong enough to blister the inside of your mouth. Then I limped into Dockside and waited for Pike and his friends to spot me. It didn't take long. I let him and 2 of his friends follow me for 1/2 mile past Seamling Lane and into Tallows. I kept to the main roads, knowing they wouldn't dare attack me in broad daylight when people were around. But when I darted into a side alley, they hurried to catch up, suspecting I was trying to make a run for it. However, when they turned the corner, no one was there. Pike thought to look up just as I was pouring the bucket of dreg onto him from the edge of the low roof above. It doused him, splashing across his face and chest. He screamed and clutched at his eyes as he went to his knees. Then I struck the phosphorus match I'd stolen and dropped it onto him, watching it sputter and flare as it fell. Full of the pure, hard hatred of a child, I hoped he would burst into a pillar of flame. He didn't, but did catch fire. He screamed again and staggered around while his friends swatted at him, trying to put him out. I left while they were busy. It had been over 1 year ago, and I hadn't seen Pike since. He hadn't tried to find me, and I had stayed well clear of Dockside, sometimes going miles out of my way rather than pass near it. It was a kind of truce. However, I didn't doubt that Pike and his friends remembered what I looked like and were willing to settle the score if they spotted me. After thinking it over, I decided it was too dangerous. Even the promise of free stories and a chance at a silver talent wasn't worth stirring things up with Pike again. Besides, what story would I ask for? The question rolled around in my head for the next few days. What story would I ask for? I jostled up against a dock worker and was cuffed away before I could get my hand all the way into his pocket. What story? I begged on the street corner opposite the Tailing Church. What story? I stole 3 loaves of bread and took 2 of them down to Trappist as a gift. What story? Then, as I lay on the rooftops in my secret place where 3 roofs met, it came to me, just as I was about to drift off to sleep. Lanray. Of course. I could ask him for the real story of Lanray, the story my father had been... My heart stuttered in my chest as I suddenly remembered things I had avoided for years. My father idly strumming at his lute, my mother beside him in the wagon singing. Reflexively, I began to draw away from the memories, the way you might pull your hand back from a fire. But I was surprised to find these memories held only a gentle ache, not the deep pain I expected. Instead, I found a small, budding excitement at the thought of hearing a story my father would have sought out, a story he himself might have told. Still, I knew it to be sheer folly to go running dockside for the sake of a story. All the hard practicality Tarbin had taught me over the years urged me to stay in my familiar corner of the world, where I was safe. The first thing I saw on entering the half-mast was Scarpy. He was sitting on a tall stool at the bar, an old man with eyes like diamonds and the body of a driftwood scarecrow. He was thin and weathered with thick white hair on his arms and face and head. The whiteness of it stood out from his deep brown tan, making him seem splashed with wave foam. At his feet were a group of 20 children, some few my age, most younger. They were a strange mix to see, ranging from grubby, shoeless urchins like myself to reasonably well-dressed, well-scrubbed children who probably had parents and homes. None of them looked familiar to me, but I never knew who might be a friend of Pike's. I found a place near the door with my back to the wall and sank down onto my haunches. Scarby cleared his throat once or twice in a way that made me thirsty. Then, with ritual significance, he looked mournfully into the clay mug that sat in front of him, and carefully turned it upside down on the bar. The children surged forward, pressing coins onto the bar. I did a quick count, 2 iron halfpennies, 9 shims and a drab. Altogether, just a little over 3 iron pennies in Commonwealth coin. Maybe he was no longer offering the silver talent bet. More likely the rumor I'd heard was wrong. The old man nodded almost imperceptibly to the bartender.
Fellow's red.
His voice was deep and rough, almost hypnotic. The bald man behind the bar gathered up the coins and deftly poured wine into Scarpy's wide clay cup.
So, what would everyone like to hear about today?
Scarpy rumbled, his deep voice rolling out like distant thunder. There was a moment of silence that again struck me as ritualistic, almost reverent. Then a babble burst forth from all the children at once.
I want a fairy story!
Orin and the Fight of the Gnats!
Yes, Orin Velsiter, the one with Baron!
Lartrum!
Murta and Eel!
Indian and the Bear!
Lanray, I said, almost without meaning to. The room went still again, as Scarpy took a drink. The children watched him with a familiar intensity I couldn't quite identify. Scarpy sat calmly in the middle of the quiet.
Did I?
His voice rolled out slowly like dark honey.
Hear someone say, Lanray.
He looked directly at me, his blue eyes clear and sharp. I nodded, not knowing what to expect.
I want to hear about the dry lands over the Stormwell,
one of the younger girls complained.
About the sand snakes that come out of the ground like sharks, and the dry men who hide under the dunes and drink your blood instead of water, and...
She was cuffed quickly into silence from a dozen different directions by the children surrounding her. Silence fell sharply as Scarpy took another drink. Watching the children as they watched Scarpy, I realized what they reminded me of. A person anxiously watching a clock. I guess that when the old man's drink was gone, the story he told would be over as well. Scarpy took another drink, no more than a sip this time, then set his cup down and pivoted on his stool to face us.
Who would like to hear the story of a man who lost his eye and gained a better sight?
Something about the tone of his voice or the reaction of the other children told me this was a purely rhetorical question.
So, Lanray and the Creation War, an old, old story.
His eyes swept over the children.
Sit and listen, for I will speak of the Shining City as it once was, years and miles away. Once, years and miles away, there was Mir Tirinnu, the Shining City. It sat among the tall mountains of the world, like a gem on the crown of a king. Imagine a city as large as Tarbin, but on every corner of every street there was a bright fountain, or a green tree growing, or a statue so beautiful it would make a proud man cry to look at it. The buildings were tall and graceful, carved from the mountain itself, carved of a bright white stone that held the sun's light long after evening fell. Selitus was lord over Mir Tirinnu. Just by looking at a thing, Selitus could see its hidden name and understand it. In those days there were many who could do such things, but Selitus was the most powerful namer of anyone alive in that age. Selitus was well loved by the people he protected. His judgments were strict and fair, and none could sway him through falsehood or dissembling. Such was the power of his sight that he could read the hearts of men like heavy-lettered books. Now in those days, there was a terrible war being fought across a vast empire. The war was called the Creation War, and the empire was called Ergen. And despite the fact that the world has never seen an empire as grand or a war so terrible, both of them only live in stories now. Even history books that mention them as doubtful rumor have long since crumbled into dust. The war had lasted so long that folk could hardly remember a time when the sky wasn't dark with the smoke of burning towns. Once there had been hundreds of proud cities scattered through the empire. Now they were merely ruins littered with the bodies of the dead. Famine and plague were everywhere, and in some places there was such despair that mothers could no longer muster enough hope to give their children names. But 8 cities remained. They were Balan, Ansus, Virates, Sinusa, Emlyn, and the twin cities of Marilla and Morella. Last was Mir Tirinnu, greatest of them all, and the only one unscarred by the long centuries of war. It was protected by the mountains and brave soldiers. But the true cause of Mir Tirinnu's peace was Selitus. Using the power of his sight, he kept watch over the mountain passes leading to his beloved city. His rooms were in the city's highest towers, so he could see any attack long before it came to be a threat. The other 7 cities, lacking Selitus's power, found their safety elsewhere. They put their trust in thick walls, in stone and steel. They put their trust in strength of arm, in valor, and bravery, and blood. And so they put their trust in Lanray. Lanray had fought since he could lift a sword, and by the time his voice began to crack, he was the equal of 12 older men. He married a woman named Lyra, and his love for her was a passion fiercer than fury. Lyra was terrible and wise, and held a power just as great as his. for while Lanre had the strength of his arm and the command of loyal men, Lyra knew the names of things, and the power of her voice could kill a man or still a thunderstorm. As the years passed, Lanre and Lyra fought side by side. They defended Balin from a surprise attack, saving the city from a foe that should have overwhelmed them. They gathered armies and made the cities recognize the need for allegiance. Over the long years, they pressed the Empire's enemies back. People who had grown numb with despair began to feel warm hope kindling inside. They hoped for peace, and they hung those flickering hopes on Lanre. Then came the Black of Drossentor. Black meant battle in the language of the time, and at Drossentor there was the largest and most terrible battle of this large and terrible war. They fought unceasing for 3 days in the light of the sun, and for 3 nights unceasing by the light of the moon. Neither side could defeat the other, and both were unwilling to retreat. Of the battle itself, I have only one thing to say. More people died at Drossentor than are living in the world today. Lanre was always where the fight was thickest, where he was needed most. His sword never left his hand or rested in its sheath. At the very end of things, covered in blood amid a field of corpses, Lanre stood alone against a terrible foe. It was a great beast with scales of black iron, whose breath was a darkness that smothered men. Lanre fought the beast and killed it. Lanre brought victory to his side, but he bought it with his life. After the battle was finished, and the enemy was set beyond the doors of stone, survivors found Lanre's body, cold and lifeless, near the beast he had slain. Word of Lanre's death spread quickly, covering the field like a blanket of despair. They had won the battle and turned the tide of the war, but each of them felt cold inside. The small flame of hope that each of them cherished began to flicker and fade. Their hopes had hung on Lanre, and Lanre was dead. In the midst of silence, Lyra stood by Lanre's body and spoke his name. Her voice was a commandment. Her voice was steel and stone. Her voice told him to live again. But Lanre lay motionless and dead. In the midst of fear, Lyra knelt by Lanre's body and breathed his name. Her voice was a beckoning. Her voice was love and longing. Her voice called him to live again. But Lanre lay cold and dead. In the midst of despair, Lyra fell across Lanre's body and wept his name. Her voice was a whisper. Her voice was echo and emptiness. Her voice begged him to live again. But Lanre lay breathless and dead. Lanre was dead. Lyra wept brokenly and touched his face with trembling hands. All around, men turned their heads because the bloody field was less horrible to look upon than Lyra's grief. But Lanre heard her calling. Lanre turned at the sound of her voice and came to her. From beyond the doors of death, Lanre returned. He spoke her name and took Lyra in his arms to comfort her. He opened his eyes and did his best to wipe away her tears with shaking hands, and then he drew a deep and living breath. The survivors of the battle saw Lanre move and they marveled. The flickering hope for peace each of them had nurtured for so long flared like hot fire inside them. Lanre and Lyra, they shouted, their voices like thunder. Our lord's love is stronger than death. Our lady's voice has called him back. Together they have beaten death. Together, how can we help but be victorious? So the war continued. but with Lanray and Lyra fighting side by side, the future seemed less grim. Soon, everyone knew the story of how Lanray had died, and how his love and Lyra's power had drawn him back. For the first time in living memory, people could speak openly of peace without being seen as fools or madmen. Years passed. The Empire's enemies grew thin and desperate, and even the most cynical of men could see the end of the war was drawing swiftly near. Then rumors began to spread. Lyra was ill. Lyra had been kidnapped. Lyra had died. Lanray had fled the Empire. Lanray had gone mad. Some even said Lanray had killed himself and gone searching for his wife in the land of the dead. There were stories aplenty, but no one knew the truth of things. In the midst of these rumors, Lanray arrived in Mir Tirinnil. He came alone, wearing his silver sword and haubergeon of black iron scales. His armor fits him closely as a second skin of shadow. He had wrought it from the carcass of the beast he had killed at Drossensor. Lanray asked Selitos to walk with him outside the city. Selitos agreed, hoping to learn the truth of Lanray's trouble and offer him what comfort a friend can give. They often kept each other's counsel, for they were both lords among their people. Selitos had heard the rumors and he was worried. He feared for Lyra's health, but more he feared for Lanray. Selitos was wise. He understood how grief can twist the heart, how passions drive good men to folly. Together, they walked the mountain paths. Lanray leading the way, they came to a high place in the mountains where they could look out over the land. The proud towers of Mir Tirinnil shone brightly in the last light of the setting sun. After a long time, Selitos said, "I have heard terrible rumors concerning your wife." Lanray said nothing, and from his silence, Selitos knew that Lyra was dead. After another long pause, Selitos tried again. "Though I do not know the whole of the matter, Mir Tirinnil is here for you, and I will lend whatever aid a friend can give." "You have given me enough, old friend." Lanray turned and placed his hand on Selitos's shoulder. "Silanxi, I bind you. By the name of stone, be still as stone. Eru, I command the air. Lay leaden on your tongue. Selitos, I name you. May all your powers fail you but your sight." Selitos knew that in all the world there were only three people who could match his skill in names: Aleph, Ajax, and Lyra. Lanray had no gift for names. His power lay in the strength of his arm. For him to attempt to bind Selitos by his name would be as fruitless as a boy attacking a soldier with a willow stick. Nevertheless, Lanray's power lay on him like a great weight, like a vice of iron, and Selitos found himself unable to move or speak. He stood still as stone and could do nothing but marvel. How had Lanray come by such power? In confusion and despair, Selitos watched night settle in the mountains. With horror, he saw that some of the encroaching blackness was in fact a great army moving upon Mir Tirinnil. Worse still, no warning bells were ringing. Selitos could only stand and watch as the army crept closer in secret. Mir Tirinnil was burned and butchered. The less that is said of it, the better. White walls were charred black and the fountains ran with blood. For a night and a day, Selitos stood helpless beside Lanray and could do nothing more than watch and listen to the screams of the dying, the ring of iron, the crack of breaking stone. When the next day dawned on the blackened towers of the city, Selitos found he could move. He turned to Lanray, and this time his sight did not fail him. he saw in Lanray a great darkness and a troubled spirit, but Selitos still felt the fetters of enchantment binding him. Fury and puzzlement warred within him, and he spoke, "Lanray, what have you done?" Lanray continued to look out over the ruins of Mir Tirinnial. His shoulders stooped as though he bore a great weight. There was a weariness in his voice when he spoke. "Was I accounted a good man, Selitos?" "You were counted among the best of us. We considered you beyond reproach. Yet I did this." Selitos could not bring himself to look upon his ruined city. "Yet you did this," he agreed. "Why?" Lanray paused. "My wife is dead. Deceit and treachery brought me to it. But her death is on my hands." He swallowed and turned to look out over the land. Selitos followed his eyes. From the vantage, high in the mountains, he saw plumes of dark smoke rising from the land below. Selitos knew with certainty and horror that Mir Tirinnial was not the only city that had been destroyed. Lanray's allies had brought about the ruin of the last bastions of the Empire. Lanray turned. "And I counted among the best." Lanray's face was terrible to look upon. Grief and despair had ravaged it. "I, considered wise and good, did all this." He gestured wildly. "Imagine what unholy things a lesser man must hold within his secret heart." Lanray faced Mir Tirinnial and a sort of peace came over him. "For them at least it is over. They are safe. Safe from the thousand evils of the everyday, safe from the banes of an unjust fate." Selitos spoke softly. "Safe from the joy and wonder." "There is no joy," Lanray shouted in an awful voice. Stones shattered at the sound and the sharp edges of echo came back to cut at them. "Any joy that grows here is quickly choked by weeds. I am not some monster who destroys out of a twisted pleasure. I sow salt because the choice is between weeds and nothing." Selitos saw nothing but emptiness behind his eyes. Selitos stooped to pick up a jagged shard of mountain glass, pointed at one end.
"Will you kill me with a stone?"
Lanray gave a hollow laugh.
"I wanted you to understand, to know it was not madness that made me do these things."
"You are not mad," Selitos admitted. "I see no madness in you."
"I hope, perhaps, that you would join me in what I aim to do."
Lanray spoke with a desperate longing in his voice.
"This world is like a friend with a mortal wound. A bitter draught given quickly only eases pain."
"Destroy the world," Selitos said softly to himself. "You are not mad, Lanray. What grips you is something worse than madness. I cannot cure you." He fingered the needle-sharp point of the stone he held.
"Will you kill me to cure me, old friend?"
Lanray laughed again, terrible and wild. Then he looked at Selitos with sudden, desperate hope in his hollow eyes.
"Can you?"
he asked.
"Can you kill me, old friend?"
Selitos, his eyes unveiled, looked at his friend. He saw how Lanray, nearly mad with grief, had sought the power to bring Lyra back to life again. Out of love for Lyra, Lanray had sought knowledge where knowledge is better left alone, and gained it at a terrible price. But even in the fullness of his hard-won power, he could not call Lyra back. Without her, Lanray's life was nothing but a burden, and the power he had taken up lay like a hot knife in his mind. To escape despair and agony, Lanray had killed himself, taking the final refuge of all men, attempting to escape beyond the doors of death. But just as Lyra's love had drawn him back from past the final door before, so this time, Lanray's power forced him to return from sweet oblivion. His new one power burned him back into his body, forcing him to live. Selitzos looked at Lanray and understood all. Before the power of his sight, these things hung like dark tapestries in the air about Lanray's shaking form. I can't kill you, Selitzos said, then looked away from Lanray's expression, suddenly hopeful. For an hour or a day, but you would return, pulled like iron to a lodestone. Your name burns with the power in you. I can no more extinguish it than I could throw a stone and strike down the moon. Lanray's shoulders bowed. I had hoped, he said simply. But I knew the truth. I am no longer the Lanray you knew. Mine is a new and terrible name. I am Haliax, and no door can bar my passing. All is lost to me. No Lyra, no sweet escape of sleep, no blissful forgetfulness, even madness is beyond me. Death itself is an open doorway to my power. There is no escape. I have only the hope of oblivion after everything is gone and the Aleu fall nameless from the sky. And as he said this, Lanray hid his face in his hands, and his body shook with silent, racking sobs. Selitzos looked out on the land below and felt a small spark of hope. Six plumes of smoke rose from the land below. Mere Tyrrhenial was gone and six cities destroyed. But that meant all was not lost. One city still remained. In spite of all that had happened, Selitzos looked at Lanray with pity, and when he spoke it was with sadness in his voice. Is there nothing, then? No hope? He lay one hand on Lanray's arm. There is sweetness in life. Even after all of this, I will help you look for it, if you will try. No, said Lanray. He stood to his full height, his face regal behind the lines of grief. There is nothing sweet. I will sow salt, lest the bitter weeds grow. I am sorry, Selitzos said, and stood upright as well. Then Selitzos spoke in a great voice. Never before has my sight been clouded. I fail to see the truth inside your hearts. Selitzos drew a deep breath. By my eye I was deceived. Never again. He raised the stone and drove its needle point into his own eye. His scream echoed among the rocks as he fell to his knees, gasping, May I never again be so blind! A great silence descended, and the fetters of enchantment fell away from Selitzos. He cast the stone at Lanray's feet and said, By the power of my own blood, I bind you. By your own name, let you be accursed. Selitzos spoke the long name that lay in Lanray's heart, and at the sound of it, the sun grew dark and wind tore stones from the mountainside. Then Selitzos spoke. This is my doom upon you. May your face be always held in shadow. Black as the toppled towers of my beloved Mere Tyrrhenial. This is my doom upon you. Your own name will be turned against you, that you shall have no peace. This is my doom upon you and all who follow you. May it last until the world ends and the Aleu fall nameless from the sky. Selitzos watched as a darkness gathered about Lanray. Soon nothing could be seen of his handsome features, only a vague impression of nose and mouth and eyes. All the rest was shadow, black and seamless. Then Selitzos stood and said, You have beaten me once through guile, but never again. Now I see truer than before, and my power is upon me. I cannot kill you, but I can send you from this place. Be gone! The sight of you is all the fouler, knowing that you once were fair.